Hi there, it's Vicky with the Talking Information Center. It's February 19th, 2026, and today I will be reading the March 2026 edition of Harper's Magazine. Our first article is entitled Easy Chair, Conventionally Grotesque, by Thomas Frank. The John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts is an enormous complex in Washington, just south of the Watergate and almost completely surrounded by highways. It is an unmistakable artifact of Cold War modernism, with its expansive facade of white marble, narrow columns, and broad terraces. The country that constructed this majestic temple to the arts was evidently a land of reason, progress, ideals, and faith in the future. America's appreciation for the arts, this edifice announced, was responsible, mature. We could be trusted to lead the world. Now that those days are over, the Kennedy Center has become the latest battleground in America's never-ending culture war. In February of last year, President Trump fired most members of the Kennedy Center's Board of Trustees and then was himself appointed its new chairman, an unusual power grab for a man who is, after all, very busy managing the nation's economic and military affairs. Over the months that followed, he dramatically increased the center's budget, and the loyalists who now run the institution declared their intention to use it to reverse the left-wing hold on American culture. One of their first moves was to select the 2025 Kennedy Center honorees, a process in which Trump was reportedly deeply involved. The list was an eccentric one. Sylvester Stallone, star of the Rocky and Rambo film franchises. The Broadway actor Michael Crawford, famous for his role in The Phantom of the Opera. The country singer George Strait. The disco legend Gloria Gaynor. And the hard rock band Kiss. The awards ceremony would be held on December 7th, with the president himself slated to act as master of ceremonies. I decided to attend and see for myself just how well the administration's cultural reconquista was going. Our story begins that chilly afternoon in the Kennedy Center's Hall of Nations, a vast room draped with flags from around the world, where a throng of journalists awaited the arrival of the honorees on an actual red carpet. Eventually, they began to appear, dressed in finery and eager to talk into any microphone held in their direction. Each of the honorees I encountered seemed thrilled to be there, almost giddy. The Trump administration officials who joined the stars, on the other hand, simply could not stop complaining. For these people, it seems, bitterness never recedes, not even in moments of triumph and celebration. Richard Grenell, a former ambassador to Germany, whom Trump had appointed interim president of the Kennedy Center, stood a few feet from me, tuxedoed and sour, grousing about his treatment by Senate Democrats and attacking the media for not giving Trump the credit he deserved for securing some $250 million to restore the building we were standing in. I heard some variation of this line several times that evening, and while it was not totally unfair, Grenell was far more concerned with pointing out the broader perversity of what he called the shameful political media. A little later, along came Carrie Lake, a former Republican candidate for a couple of offices in Arizona, who now serves as a senior advisor at the U.S. Agency for Global Media, where her duties have included, among other things, dismantling the broadcaster Voice of America. Her talk as she worked the red carpet was smooth, glib, and yet always prickly, a monotonous stream of words that made her occasional sarcasm nearly undetectable. At one point, Lake was describing the greatness of the honorees to a reporter from Reuters, America's where disco was founded, but quickly pivoted to the subject she really cared about. Nobody is into garbage, DEI, LGBTQ+, all that stuff. Nobody wants that woke stuff, she said. It's not entertaining. You want to see how the movie industry's been ruined in Hollywood? By pushing and forcing down our throats this woke garbage. Meanwhile, behind Lake, Paul Stanley of Kiss and the magician Chris Angel were getting their pictures taken, pointing at each other and then holding the pose, Stanley in a tuxedo, sans face paint, Angel in a rhinestone-encrusted jacket, dark glasses, and a pair of knee-high platform boots. Lake took no notice. Her onslaught continued. I know the people in the media are shaking their heads. They're shocked by this, but I'm telling you, the American people don't want it. I know Reuters is offended that I just said that, and Reuters, they want the woke garbage, but we want arts that are just entertaining and not trying to force an agenda down our throat. We don't want woke garbage. We want entertainment, arts, beauty. Okay, thank you, said the guy from Reuters. But Lake wouldn't let it go. Now she was interviewing him. Do you like woke garbage? PC woke garbage? The reporter demurred. A few feet away, Stanley was now being photographed with his family, holding up the medal given to him by the president, and then moving on down the hall, smiling and happy. Lake was still going. Nobody wants the woke garbage. And so, thank God, Ambassador Grinnell came in and said, we're not going to do that. We're going to push for the great, great arts, and I think we're going to see that tonight. A word about those great, great arts. Since his first moments on the political stage, the arts community has treated Donald Trump as a kind of devil figure, the subject of unflattering sculptures and nasty speeches at award ceremonies. Trump and his followers have responded in kind, of course. Culture war is their lifeblood, and they revel in deploring artsy elites. Trump's taste is the stuff of legend, a sort of grotesque of the conventional, with his gold Baroque glop and fake tans and bright red neckties, everything gesturing towards high-end elegance, but always wrong somehow, always slightly too much. The Kennedy Center, somewhat Trumpian already with its enormous chandeliers and richly upholstered opera house, has furnished him the grandest stage yet on which to work his artistic will. And on that day in December, we got to find out firsthand how he would replace the woke garbage condemned by Lake. We knew the president was on his way when the White House pool photographers filed through the door and took up their positions in front of the velvet rope. Eventually, Trump himself entered the hall, now as quiet as a library, and began making his way very slowly down the red carpet with the First Lady, stopping every few steps to take a question. The president expounded on many of the subjects of the day, tariffs, corporate mergers, Ukraine, the eight wars he had supposedly ended. But it was art that we were there to celebrate. Did Trump like country music? Someone asked. Oh, yes. What other president might have made a good MC? Maybe John F. Kennedy. Why had he chosen to honor Kiss? I like them as people, he said, adding that he also listened to their music. They are characters, too, they really are. The best question came from a reporter standing just to my left, who asked the president, in your opinion, what makes a song great? Trump, without a second's hesitation, it's something that has to be soft and soothing to your ear. A few minutes later, the president ducked into a hallway, and the throng of reporters finally disbanded. In the time it took me to gulp some water and find my seat in the opera house, Trump had already taken the stage and was well into his routine, standing behind a podium decorated with the presidential seal. What had brought the night's disparate honorees together? And what did these choices tell us about the movement that now rules in Washington? On one level, not very much. None of the choices were obscure or idiosyncratic. They all represented genres that have been recognized at the Kennedy Center many times before, and together they offered something for everyone. As the president told us on the red carpet, they're outstanding people, every one of them very different, totally different audience, but when you add them up, it's 100% of our country. The honorees were figures of the 70s and 80s, Trump's salad days, and several of them had some obvious connection to chapters in his past, his disco period, for example. But there were also political elements to the choices. Some of the honorees were the sort of people whom any Republican administration would single out. Stallone, for example, was once the muscular embodiment of Reagan-era backlash, inflicting grievous revenge on the people who kicked us out of Vietnam, and also smashing up the bureaucracy that caused us to lose that fine war. But celebrating the disco era by honoring its great superstar, Gloria Gaynor? This felt like new territory for the hard right. After all, scholars have been assuring us for years that disco was a site of subversion, liberation, and transgression, and yet these findings clearly did not trouble the MAGA gang. The bigger mystery was the inclusion of KISS, whose members once dressed in outrageous costumes and horrified church-going America by spitting fake blood and boasting about their sexual exploits. As it happens, I was a conservative in those days, a gawky and troubled teenager in a gawky and troubled decade, and what drew me to the right back then was my revulsion at the flagrant decadence of American culture, which was epitomized for me by KISS. I got over it eventually, but still, the thought that right-wingers now chose to honor KISS as a wholesome and admirable expression of American musical and marketing genius generated enough cognitive dissonance to make me dizzy for days. It is the fate of every culture war to be forgotten, of course, and we all know about Trump's views on personal morality. Even so, when the program segued after a short intermission from a performance of a Gaynor gospel number, talking about Jesus, backed by a choir in robes, to a video in which the president, seated at the Resolute desk, hailed KISS as one of the greatest rock bands of all time, I felt I was witnessing something important, a high watermark in friction-free contradiction. As a festival of flattery, the Kennedy Center honor aligns precisely with the MAGA sensibility. There is a reason that Donald Trump chose to personally emcee this event rather than, say, rewrite placards at the National Portrait Gallery. The honors are an organized, choreographed ladling out of praise, much like one of the president's cabinet meetings. Here's how it works, if you've never seen it on TV. The honorees take their seats in a high balcony from which almost everyone in the audience can see them. Meanwhile, their friends and admirers take turns describing how awesome and accomplished they are. Their signature songs are covered. Their great moments on the stage and screen are relived. Their adventures and their virtues are recounted. And we, the audience, get to see how the artists, mute and unmicrophoned in their high seats, react to this lengthy and really quite embarrassing bill of commendation. Do they wince? Do they squirm? Do they sing along? This year, the formula was scrambled by the onstage presence of the nation's chief executive, who basked in the applause earned by the others, but added little himself to the proceedings. If you've been to a Trump event, you're familiar with his flat, passionless, oratorical style as he reads from a teleprompter. They're among the greatest artists and actors, performers, singers, and songwriters ever to walk the face of the earth, he said in his introductory remarks, but he might as well have been placing an order at McDonald's. One of the only moments when the president showed actual feeling was when, speaking about persistence, he addressed his haters in the audience. I know so many of you, and you are persistent. Many of you are miserable, horrible people. Sometimes I'd wish you'd give up, but you don't. That made me laugh. The public, however, knew what to expect from this unwholesome mixture of politics and celebrity and didn't tune in, which is to say ratings for the Kennedy Center honors dropped to an all-time low. But the culture warriors fought on. 11 days after the president's lackluster turn as MC, the Kennedy Center's board voted to rename the complex the Donald J. Trump and the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts. New lettering to that effect went up on the building's facade the next day. Now the war began in earnest. Members of the Kennedy family were apoplectic. A U.S. representative from Ohio sued Trump and the Kennedy Center's Board of Trustees over the matter, arguing that changing the building's name required an act of Congress. Washington is a liberal town, of course, and Trump's defiling of the Kennedy Center, like his earlier deployment of National Guard troops in the city's streets, caused predictable outrage. Ticket sales for holiday shows were dismal, and a wave of cancellations by performers nixed much of the season's schedule. The nation's new commissars struck back in their usual way. Richard Grenell, whose bitter complaints about the media were we heard earlier, threatened to sue Chuck Redd, a jazz musician who had canceled a Christmas Eve performance. For good measure, Grenell also accused the musician of intolerance and ridiculed him for being unpopular. Meanwhile, on Truth Social, the president wrote enthusiastically about the marble armrests he hoped to see installed and shared the posts of supporters who reveled in the pain that the renaming would no doubt bring to liberals. It still surprises me, after all these years, how many Trumpian initiatives can be explained by this simple, spiteful compulsion. Maybe a performing arts center is exactly the right place for it. After all, one of the persistent impulses of modern art has been to antagonize people of correct sensibilities, to subvert their cherished institutions. Now here it is in the service of political reaction, the ultimate provocation, the shock of the tacky. Harper's Index. Portion of people detained by ICE between October 1st and November 15, 2025, who had a prior violent criminal conviction, 1 to 20. Who had no prior criminal convictions, 3 to 4. Percentage of U.S. Catholic priests ordained before 1980 who are extremely concerned about the Trump administration, 63. Of those ordained since 2000, 20. Percentage of Americans who say that a belief in God is an important part of being truly American, 57. Who say that having Western European heritage is, 23. Percentage of Republicans who support a bill that would allow private citizens to fight drug cartels and seize their assets, 41. Who say they would likely fight cartels themselves, 20. Percentage of U.S. Foreign Service officers who report lower morale since Trump's election, 98. Percentage of Americans in 1997 who said that the United Nations played a necessary role in the world, 85. In 2025, 60. Portion of UN General Assembly resolutions since 2020 on which the United States voted with the majority, 1 to 3. On which China did, 1 to 2. Percentage decrease since 1990 in the number of people living in extreme poverty worldwide, 64. Percentage by which this number is projected to increase by 2040, 13. Portion of U.S. small business owners who plan to hire new staff or otherwise expand this year, 1 out of 10. Who worry that their business will not survive the year, 3 out of 4. Percentage of U.S. employees who say they regularly feign working while at their desks, 58. Who say they have typed nonsense on their keyboard in order to seem busy, 22. Who say they have feigned being on the phone, 15. Chance that an American aged 35 to 60 with more than $500,000 in investable assets uses AI for investing advice, 1 in 3, that they act on this advice without conducting any further research, 1 in 20. Percentage of Americans earning more than $100,000 per year who are skipping or considering skipping meals to save money, 41. Who have recently pretended that a payment app wasn't working to avoid paying someone, 39. Percentage of those making more than $200,000 per year who have done this recently, 48. Number of subscription services that the average U.S. household paid for in 2024, 4.1. In 2025, 2.8. Percent increase over the past year in Yelp searches in the United States for cheap eats, 21. For best places to eat alone, 150. percentage of Americans who say that making plans with friends feels like scheduling a work meeting, 53. Portion of U.S. obituaries published in 2019 that used at least one word connoting benevolence, such as love or sympathy, 4 out of 5. Of those published in 2024, 3 out of 5. Portion of Americans in 1998 who believed that all cancers would be cured by 2025, 3 out of 5. Who believed that space travel would be common for ordinary Americans by then, 3 out of 10. Who believed that humans would make contact with extraterrestrial life by then, 1 out of 4. Estimated chance that any person ever born is currently alive, 1 in 14. Percentage of Americans who, given the choice of living sometime in the past, present, or future, would choose the past, 45. The present, 40. The future, 14. Readings. Essay, Trotsky's Scream, by Josh Ireland, from The Death of Trotsky, The True Story of the Plot to Kill Stalin's Greatest Enemy, which was published last month by Dutton. Leon Trotsky's whitewashed study, which abutted his simply furnished bedroom, was bright, high-ceilinged, and unadorned, though its floor was painted a striking deep red. In its stern elegance, the study was in many ways a reflection of its occupant. Light streamed through a balcony window to which Trotsky usually turned his back as he worked. He spent so much of his time here that there was even a couch for his siestas. There were no ornaments, no photos, no paintings. The chairs were plain and caned-bottomed. What decoration there was came from a map of Mexico. Trotsky sat down in his armchair. Ramon Mercader, a.k.a. Frank Jackson, felt a rush of confidence. Everything was going as well as he could have hoped. The desk behind which Trotsky sat was wide and stacked with magazines and books. On top of it sat an ivory paper knife, pens and pencils in a jar, along with a blotter, a gooseneck lamp, and his bulky dictaphone. Within reach was a .25 caliber automatic pistol. Elsewhere in the study was a Colt 38. Both were loaded with 6 cartridges. Mercader stood to Trotsky's left. He casually tossed his overcoat onto the table to ensure that Trotsky could not reach for the recently installed alarm switch. Then he perched on the desk and watched as Trotsky reviewed an article he had written. Mercader's position gave him a view of Trotsky's balding head. Then Mercader acted. Later he said that he was anxious not to lose the brilliant opportunity that was offered me. At the exact moment that Trotsky started to read, Mercader took a piolet from the pocket of his raincoat. At the end of its heavy, foot-long wooden shaft was a steel head that ran 7 inches. One end had been sharpened to a vicious point. The other was a forked hammer claw. It was this broad end that Mercader bashed into Trotsky's skull, leaving a gory 2.5-inch wound. But it did not kill him instantly. Trotsky screamed in such a way that Mercader immediately knew that he would never forget the sound as long as he lived. His scream was a long, endlessly long, "Ah!" "And it still seems to me as if that scream were piercing my brain," Mercader later confessed. Mercader's excitement in this moment had reached such a pitch that he did not look for the knife he'd hidden in his coat lining. The impact of that scream paralyzed him. Blood spattered onto Trotsky's papers, which included his biography of Stalin and a file he had been keeping on the NKVD. Trotsky hurled items from the desk at Mercader before wrestling the ice pick from his grip. He then leaped up like a madman and threw himself at his assassin, biting his hand with such force that marks were still visible during Mercader's interrogation a few days later. Mercader pushed Trotsky to the floor and, running and stumbling, escaped from the room. Trotsky staggered out of the study in the other direction. His wife, Natalia, had heard a terrible, heartbreaking cry, although she didn't immediately realize that it had come from her husband. She rushed toward the sound and was confronted by the sight of him leaning against the door that led from the dining room to the balcony, his arms dangling. His face was covered in blood, but what really struck Natalia was the way that his blue eyes, unshielded by glasses, glittered. "The keys aren't in his car," he said. "Excuse me. I apologize. I skipped ahead accidentally a page." "What happened? What happened?" she cried and flung her arms around him. Trotsky briefly became unresponsive as Natalia frantically tried to work out what had transpired. Had something fallen from the ceiling? At that moment, Natalia later wrote, Trotsky said one word, calmly, without any distortion, bitterness, or despair. Jackson. It was as if, she later thought, he were conveying a last message. Now it is done. As soon as he heard Trotsky's scream, Joseph Hansen, his secretary, felt an unidentifiable dread surge through his body. He sprinted from the guardhouse to the roof. His first thought was that one of the builders had had an accident. But then he heard the unmistakable sounds of a life-or-death confrontation coming from the study. He glimpsed Melquiades Benitez, the handyman, pointing his rifle at the window below and caught a flash of Trotsky in his blue work jacket in a body-to-body struggle with someone else. "Don't shoot!" Hansen shouted at Benitez. "You might hit the old man." He switched on an alarm, descended a ladder to the library, and just as he entered the door that connected the library to the dining room, encountered the bloodied Trotsky. Hansen asked him what had happened. "Jackson shot me with a revolver," Trotsky told him. "I am seriously wounded. I feel that this time it is the end." "It is only a surface wound. You will recover. We talked about French statistics." "Did he hit you from behind?" Trotsky made no answer. "No, he did not shoot you. We didn't hear any shot. He struck you with something." Trotsky gave a skeptical look and pressed Hansen's hand. He had been speaking to Natalia in Russian at the same time that he had been answering his secretary's questions. At intervals, he brought her hand to his lips. "Natasha, I love you. Oh, oh. No one must be allowed to see you without being searched." Natalia placed a pillow beneath his wounded head, held a piece of ice to his rapidly swelling wound, and wiped blood from his face with a cotton ball. Speaking with mounting effort, his voice getting fainter and coming close to breaking, Trotsky ordered Siva, his grandson, to be taken away to safety. But it was obviously that he did not realize that he was having difficulty speaking. "You know, in there," he said, indicating the study with his eyes, "I sensed, understood what he wanted to do. He wanted to strike me once more, but I didn't let him." There was a hint of pride in his words. Hansen left Trotsky with Natalia and entered the study. He found a panic-stricken Mercator desperately trying to escape from the bodyguard, Harold Robbins. An automatic pistol lay on the table. On the floor was a blood-spattered instrument which looked to me like a prospector's pick. Robin stood over the injured Mercator, who was covered in both his own and Trotsky's blood. Hansen passed on Trotsky's order to not kill Mercator. Robbins replied, "I'm not going to kill him, but I'm going to crush his bones and make his body a sieve if he doesn't tell us right away who he works for." Robbins struck Mercator. Blow followed blow. Robbins' shouts of, "Admit it, it's the GPU who sent you," alternated with the dull thump of bones crushing into bone as Mercator denied. "No, not the GPU." Mercator slipped into unconsciousness twice, resurfacing to offer up more vague, contradictory claims that seemed scripted. Hansen remembered thinking, that was the first I realized how hard this person really was. He would sooner die than talk. At one point, Mercator came to and moaned, "They have imprisoned my mother. Sylvia Egeloff had nothing to do with this. No, it was not the GPU. I have nothing to do with the GPU." Finally, a shove from Robbins convinced Mercator that this, his last moment, had arrived. He convulsed in fear. "It's them! Them!" "Who? Them?" Robbins yelled. "Come on, speak!" "A man. I don't know him, but he made me do this." "How did he make you do this?" "They've got me." There was a pause, as if Mercator was assessing the wisdom of what he was about to say. Then, "They're holding my mother hostage." Robbins, convinced he was still being lied to, continued to push for more information. He repeated his questions over and over, each time with more malice in his voice. Mercator expanded his story. He'd been ordered to kill Trotsky by a man named Paris, who was also known as Bartolo or Bartolo Perez. Mercator had met this Paris or Bartolo Perez in Paris and then encountered him again 3 weeks earlier in Mexico at the Kit Kat Club at the corner of the Avenida Independencia and Calle Dolores. At this, Hansen joined in, hitting Mercator so hard that he broke his own hand. Mercator started pleading, "Kill me! Kill me at once! I don't deserve to live! Kill me! I received no orders from the GPU, but kill me anyway!" They were interrupted by Charles Cornell, another guard, who exploded into the study. "The keys aren't in his car," he said. Cornell fumbled with Mercator's clothing, trying to find them. Nothing. As Cornell searched, Hansen ran out and opened the garage doors. Then Cornell sped off in Trotsky's cars, and Hansen returned to Trotsky. Like Natalia, he knelt on the floor, holding Trotsky's hands. "He hit you with a pick," Hansen told Trotsky again. "He did not shoot you. I am sure it is only a surface wound." "No, I feel it here," Trotsky gestured to his heart, "that this time they have succeeded." "No, it's only a surface wound. You'll get better." Trotsky's eyes betrayed gentle amusement at Hansen's clumsy attempt to reassure him. "Take care of Natalia. She has been with me many, many years." After this request, he began gazing at his wife. "He seemed to be drinking in what her features were like," remembered Hansen later, "as if he were leaving her forever, in these fleeting seconds compressing all of the past into a last glance." "We will," Hansen promised. All three knew that Trotsky was nearing the end. He pressed Natalia and Hans's hands, his eyes filled with tears. Natalia wept and kissed his hand. Anatomy, Rabbi Hole, by Wayne Kostenbaum, from My Lover, the Rabbi, which will be published this month by Farrar, Strauss, and Gouraud. My lover, the rabbi, developed an anal ailment, not life-threatening, not connected to digestion, not caused by sexual activity, not contagious, not within the purview of most medical practitioners he consulted, until he found one kindly doctor who specialized in anal ailments and who was happy to engage with the rabbi in extended conversation about his symptoms. There were almost no visible signs of this pestering affliction, which interfered with the rabbi's sleep and therefore with his mental competence and his negotiation of daytime duties and professional matters. For no clear reason, the rabbi hesitated to tell me the explicit diagnosis of his ailment and of the treatment recommended by the kindly specialist whose office was right next door to a cafe that served, my lover said, the strongest and most flavorful coffee he could remember tasting. And so he looked forward to his visits to the anal specialist because these consultations afforded my lover a chance to drink a large cup of the legendary coffee he craved. My lover insisted that the coffee could be consumed only after the medical visit. I don't understand why the rabbi was shy about naming his condition. So parsimonious was he about divulging information concerning this sickness and its treatment that he entrusted only Monica Prague and never me to pick up from the pharmacy the pills and ointments prescribed to bring about, slowly after months of dosage, the cure, or at least the remission, because it was possible that his anal ailment would never heal and that it would become a permanent part of the rabbi's identity. The stories he told himself about his own perilous and erratic progress through the world would be reshaped to place this anal ailment at the summit of his pilgrimage. Every past event, including his marriage to Carla, the death of their son Rockland, and all the subsequent rabbinical and therapeutic successes visited upon him in the ensuing years, would be reinterpreted as consequences or predictions of the anal crux, the centerpiece of his career, the cornerstone of his psyche, the escutcheon by which his friends and enemies would recognize him, even if they were never privy to the inside story of the ailment. I wanted to be the party encrusted to pick up the medicines from the pharmacy, but this task, this honor, he refused me, and my resentment of Monica Prague's dominion grew. I have been some days jealous of the attention the rabbi pays to Dominic, the dog walker, but my envy of Monica Prague far exceeded my jealousy of Dominic. Why wasn't Monica Prague allowed to walk and feed the dog? I used to wonder, until the rabbi explained to me that Monica had one major flaw, which was her hatred of animals, domestic or wild. She believed that dogs should be put to death whenever possible, the rabbi said. But was he exaggerating her disdain? Was he painting her as caniphobic so that I would cease to resent Monica Prague for dominating his life? The specialist, my butt doctor, the rabbi proudly called him, did not forbid anal intercourse. Nonsense, Dr. Regis told him. You could invite the whole Russian army up your behind. There's no problem with anyone or anything entering that area, as long as you're religious about your nightly application of the ointment, and as long as you take the oral medication 3 times a day on an empty stomach. I could thus enjoy the rabbi's back entrance as much as usual, Dr. Regis said, but a strange bifurcation arose. The behind, as medical entity, grew starkly differentiated from the behind as a pleasure zone. The mythologies of the medical behind could blossom, like the oral folklore of a tribe allowed to retain its own myths without the colonizing interference of invaders. And the erotic aspects of the behind, too, could swell their tanks with new conscripts, new stories, new vibrations and vulnerabilities. The medical behind and the erotic behind never met by day or by night. The two cultures were separated by an iron curtain or firewall. My relation was with the erotic behind. The medical behind he kept secret from me. Monica Prague was admitted into the company of the medical behind, but I could only look longingly at that realm from the sidelines and fruitlessly yearn for a day when I might be admitted to the fold. Letter from San Francisco. Child's Play, Tex, New Generation, and the End of Thinking, by Sam Criss. The first sign that something in San Francisco had gone very badly wrong was the signs. In New York, all the advertising on the streets and on the subway assumes that you, the person reading, are an ambiently depressed 28-year-old office worker whose main interests are listening to podcasts, ordering delivery, and voting for the Democrats. I thought I found that annoying, but in San Francisco, they don't bother advertising normal things at all. The city is temperate and brightly colored, with plenty of pleasant trees, but on every corner it speaks to you in an aggressively alien nonsense. Here the world automatically assumes that instead of wanting food or drinks or a new phone or a car, what you want is some kind of arcane B2B service for your startup. You are not a passive consumer. You are making something. This assumption is remarkably out of step with the people who actually inhabit the city's public space. At a bus stop, I saw a poster that read, "Today, Sock 2 is done before your AI girlfriend breaks up with you. It's done in Delve." Beneath it, a man squatted on the pavement, staring at nothing in particular, a glass pipe drooping from his fingers. I don't know if he needed Sock 2 done any more than I did. A few blocks away, I saw a billboard that read, "No one cares about your product. Make them. Unify. Transform growth into a science." A man paced in front of the advertising, chanting to himself, "This is necessary. This is necessary." On each necessary, he swung his arms up in exaltation. He was, I noticed, holding an alarmingly large baby pink pocket knife. Passerby, in sight of the billboard that read, excuse me, "Wearable Tech Share Insights," did not seem piqued by the prospect of having their metrics constantly analyzed. I couldn't find anyone who wanted to prompt it, then push it. After spending slightly too long in the city, I found that the various forms of nonsense all started to bleed into one another. The motionless people drooling on the sidewalk, the Waymo swooshing around with no one inside, a kind of pervasive mindlessness. Had I seen a billboard or a madman preaching about a CRM so smart it updates itself? Was it a person in rags muttering about how all his movements were being controlled by shadowy powers working out of a data center somewhere? Or was it a car? Somehow people managed to live here, but of all the strange and maddening messages posted around this city, there was one particular type of billboard that the people of San Francisco couldn't bear. People shuddered at the sight of it, or groaned, or covered their eyes. The advertiser was the most utterly despised startup in the entire tech landscape. Weirdly, its ads were the only ones I saw that appeared to be written in anything like English. "Hi, my name is Roy. I got kicked out of school for cheating. Buy my cheating tool, Cluely.com. Cluely and its co-founder, Chungin Roy Lee, were intensely and intentionally controversial. They're no longer in San Francisco, having been essentially chased out of the city by the Planning Commission. The company is loathed, seemingly out of proportion to what its product actually is, which is a janky, glitching interface for ChatGPT and other AI models. It's not in a particularly glamorous market. Cluely is pitched at ordinary office drones in their 30s, working ordinary BS email jobs. It's there to assist you in Zoom meetings and sales calls. It involves using AI to do your job for you, but this is what pretty much everyone is doing already. The cafes of San Francisco are full of highly paid tech workers clattering away on their keyboards. If you peer at their screens to get a closer look, you'll generally find them copying and pasting material from a ChatGPT window. A lot of the other complaints about Cluely seemed similarly hypocritical. The company is fueled by cheap viral hype rather than an actual workable product. But this is a strange thing to get upset about when you consider that back in the era of zero interest rates, Silicon Valley investors sank $120 million into something called the Juicero, a Wi-Fi-enabled smart juicer that could make fresh juice from fruit satchels that you could, it turned out, just as easily squeeze between your hands. What I discovered, though, is that behind all of these small complaints, there's something much more serious. Roy Lee is not like other people. He belongs to a new and possibly permanent overclass. One of the pervasive new doctrines of Silicon Valley is that we're in the early stages of a bifurcation event. Some people will do incredibly well in the new IA era. They will become rich and powerful beyond anything we can currently imagine. But other people, a lot of other people, will become useless. They will be consigned to the same miserable fate as the people currently muttering on the streets of San Francisco, cold and helpless in a world they no longer understand. The skills that could lift you out of the new permanent underclass are not the skills that mattered before. For a long time, the tech industry liked to think of itself as a meritocracy. It rewarded qualities like intelligence, competence, and expertise. But all of that barely matters anymore. Even at big firms like Google, a quarter of the code is now being written by AI. Individual intelligence will mean nothing once we have superhuman AI, at which point the difference between an obscenely talented giga nerd and an ordinary six-pack drinking bozo will be about as meaningful as the difference between any two ants. It's what you If what you do involves anything related to the human capacity for reason, reflection, insight, creativity, or thought, you will be meat for the Colton mines. The future will belong to people with a very specific combination of personality traits and psychosexual neuroses. An AI might be able to code faster than you, but there is one advantage that humans still have. It's called agency, or being highly agentic. The highly agentic are people who just do things. They don't timidly wait for permission or consensus. They drive like bulldozers through whatever's in their way. When they see something that could be changed in the world, they don't write a lengthy critique. They change it. AIs are not capable of accessing whatever unpleasant childhood experience it is that gives you this hunger. Agency is now the most valuable commodity in Silicon Valley. In tech interviews, it's common for candidates to be asked whether they're mimetic or agentic. You do not want to say mimetic. Once, San Francisco drew in runaway children, artists, and freaks. Today, it's an enormous magnet for highly agentic young men. I set out to meet them. Roy Lee's personal mythology is now firmly established. At the beginning of 2025, he was an undergraduate at Columbia, where he, like most of his fellow students, was using AI to do essentially all of his work for him. The personal essay that got him into the university was also written with AI. He wasn't there to learn. He was there to find someone to co-found a startup with. That person ended up being an engineering student named Neil Shanmugam, who tends to hover in the background of every article about Cluely. The startup they founded was called Interview Coder, and it was a tool for cheating on LeetCode. LeetCode is a training platform for the kind of algorithmic riddles that usually crop up in interviews for big tech companies. Sample problem. Suppose an array of length n sorted in ascending order is rotated between 1 and n times. Return the minimum element of this array. Roy thought these questions were pointless. These were not problems coders would actually face on the job. And even if they were, the fact that ChatGPT could now solve them instantly had rendered worthless the human ability to do so. Interview Coder was a transparent window that could overlay one side of a Zoom meeting, allowing Claude to listen in on the questions and provide answers. Roy filmed himself using it during an interview for an internship with Amazon. They offered him a place. He declined and uploaded the footage to YouTube, where it very quickly made him famous. Columbia arranged a disciplinary hearing, which he also secretly filmed and posted online. The university suspended him for a year. He dropped out, started an upgraded version of Interview Coder dubbed Cluely, and moved to San Francisco to begin raking in tens of millions of dollars in venture capital funding. Roy envisioned Cluely being used for greater purposes than job interviews. The startup's mainstream breakthrough was a viral ad that showed Roy using a pair of speculative, Cluely-enabled glasses on a blind date. His date asks how old he is. Cluely tells him to say he's 30. When the date starts going badly, Cluely pulls up her amateur painting of a tulip from the internet and tells him to compliment her art. "You're such an unbelievably talented artist. Do you think you can give me just one chance to show you I can make this work?" The video launched alongside a manifesto, which was seemingly churned out by AI. "We build Cluely so you never have to think alone again. It sees your screen, hears your audio, feeds you answers in real time. Why memorize facts, write code, research anything, when a model can do it in seconds? The future won't reward effort. It will reward leverage." The future they seem to envision is one in which people don't really do anything at all, except follow the instructions given to them by machines. Cluely's offices were in a general disheveled corner of the city, crouching near an elevated freeway. On the ground floor, I found a stack of foam costumes in plastic crates, each neatly labeled Sonic Hedgehog, Olaf Snowman, Pikachu. A significant part of working at Cluely seemed to involve dressing up as cartoon characters for viral videos. Through a door, I could just glimpse a dingy fitness dungeon housing two treadmills and a huge pile of discarded Amazon boxes. On one of the machines, a Cluely employee panted and huffed in the dark. We avoided eye contact. Upstairs, Roy and his coterie were huddled around a laptop, fiddling with Cluely's interface. Remember, one said, the average user is like 35 years old. This is a totally unfamiliar interface. Apparently, a 35-year-old wouldn't be expected to know how to use anything more advanced than a rotary phone. Another employee scrutinized the proposed new layout. I think it's bad, he said, but it's low-key not worse. What we have is, anyway, really bad, so anything is better. They started arguing about chevrons. Through all of this, Roy scrolled through X on his phone, simultaneously baby-faced and creatine swollen, he was wearing gym clothes with two curtains of black hair swung over his forehead. Finally, he looked up. So number one, he said, we're killing the chat bar on the left. There was no number two, meaning over. Suddenly, Roy seemed to acknowledge my presence. He offered me a tour. There was something he very badly wanted to impress on me, which was that Cluely cultivates a fratty tech bro atmosphere. Their pantry was piled high with bottles of something called Core Power Elite. I was offered a protein bar. The inside of the wrapper read, Daily Intentions, Be My Boss Self. We're big believers in protein, Roy said. It's impossible to get fat at Cluely. Nothing here has any fat. The kitchen table was stacked with Labubu dolls. It's aesthetics, Roy explained. Women love Labubus, so we have Labubus. He showed me his bedroom, which was in the office. Many Cluely staffers also lived there. Everything was gray, although there wasn't much. I'm a big believer in minimalism, he said. Actually, no, I'm not. Not at all. I just don't really care about interior decoration. He had a chest of drawers, entirely empty except for a lint roller, pens, and in one corner, a sex toy. It's for girls, you know, said Roy. There was also some objects that didn't seem to belong in a frat house. In one of the common areas, a shelving unit was completely empty except for an anime figurine. You could peer up her plastic skirt and see her plastic underwear. More figures in frilly dresses seemed to have been scattered at random throughout the building. Roy showed me his Hinge profile. He was looking for a 5'2 Asian, pre-med, matcha-loving, funny, watches anime, white dog-having, intelligent, ambitious, well-dressed, clean, 19 to 21-year-old. One picture showed him cuddling a giant Labubu. I told Roy that I might try interviewing him with Cluely running in the background so I could see if it would ask him better questions than I would. He seemed to think it was only natural that I'd want to be essentially a fleshy interface between himself and his own product. He booted up Cluely on his laptop, and it immediately failed to work. Roy stormed downstairs to the product floor. Cluely's not working, he said. This was followed by roughly 15 minutes of panicked tinkering as his hand-picked team of elite coders tried to get their product back online. Once they had done so, we resumed our places, whereupon Cluely immediately went down again. Roy has a kind of idol status within the company, but he's aware that a lot of people instinctively take against him. I'd say about 80% of the time, people do not like me. He knows why, too. I'm putting myself out there in an extremely vocal way. When I talk, I tend to dominate the conversation. Roy does talk a lot, but there's also something mildly unnerving about the way he talks. Everything he says is very precise and direct. He doesn't or ah. He doesn't take time to think things over. Zero latency. In the various videos that Cluely seems to spend most of its time and money producing, he usually plays a slightly dopey, dithering, relatable figure. In person, it's like he's running a functioning version of his app inside his own head. I asked him whether he'd ever try modifying the way he interacts with people to see whether they would dislike him less. Very unnatural to me, he said. I just say it's not worth it. According to Roy, everyone would describe him as an extremely extrovert with zero social anxiety. During his brief stint at Columbia, he immersed himself in New York life by striking up conversations with random people. For instance, a homeless person he took to Shake Shack. I think it was an expansion of what I thought I was able to do. It was probably the most different person that I've ever talked to. He was not very coherent, but I was very scared at first. And then as we got to talking, or as he got to mumbling, I eased up like, oh, he's not going to kill me. Roy's bravery did not extend to talking to women. Young men usually is who I like to go out and talk to. Women get intimidated and, you know, I don't want any charges. Meanwhile, those conversations with young men all followed a very predictable path. I go, and pretty much to every single person I meet, I ask if you want to start a company with me. Would you like to be my co-founder? And most of them say no. In fact, everybody says no. He was just glad to be among people. Roy had initially been offered a place at Harvard, but the offer was rescinded. He hadn't told them about a suspension in high school. This presented Roy's family with a problem. His parents ran a college prep agency that promised to help children get into elite schools like Harvard. It would not look good if their own son was conspicuously not at Harvard. So Roy spent the entirety of the next year at home. I maybe left my room like 8 times. I think if there was such a thing as depression, then I believe I might have had some variation of depression. Later, he told me that isolation is probably the scariest thing in the world. Folks, that's all the time we have left for today. On behalf of the Talking Information Center, this is Vicki. Thanks so very much for listening, and have a wonderful day.